This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Place to Be Nation Pop. Welcome back to Pop Goes a Classic Disney here in a Place to Be Nation Pop experience. I just said that. I like to repeat myself quite often on these shows. But well, I'm back again here with my good friends, my co-hosts, and we're here discussing another classic Disney feature. Let's bring them in and we'll get going on that. First off, introducing Steve Riddle. Hey, Steve, how you doing?
Hey, Andy, I'm doing good.
All right. Are you excited to chat about this particular film tonight?
I am. Yeah, this is definitely... I remember definitely liking this film a lot growing up, so looking forward to getting back into it.
All right, and also rounding out our crew, the lovely lady, Miranda Berthold. How are you, Miranda?
I'm good.
Yeah? And how are you feeling about the movie we're discussing tonight?
I really enjoyed this one, too. Growing up, I actually have memories of watching it with my siblings, and one of my brothers really loved this one, so we watched it a lot. I really enjoyed this one. I'm glad we're talking about this one.
And that film is the classic from 1961, 101 Dalmatians. It was kind of the return to the animal, although, you know, it was only been one movie since Lady and the Tramp, but this is, you know, told from the dog's point of view. They refer to the humans as their pets, which is a lot of fun aspect to this movie. So, guys, let's go through around like we like to do, talk about our earliest memories of seeing this movie and how it has lasted with you to this day. So, Miranda, we'll start with you. What are your early memories of 101 Dalmatians and your feelings on it to up to now?
So I'm pretty sure this is another one that I probably watched very young with my grandmother. But I remember being a little bit older and watching it with my brothers a lot. Both of my brothers, one is 5 years younger than me and one's 3 years younger than me. And I remember both of them really, really, really loved this movie. We had it on VHS. That would have been all you could have had it on at the time. But we had it on VHS, and it got played repetitively. And what was really funny is when we were little, my brother was terrified of dogs, but this was like his favorite movie. And I have always really loved dogs. So I think kind of, you know, young Miranda was like, talking dogs, what? You know, and I liked this one a little bit better than I liked Lady and the Tramp, as much as Lady and the Tramp was one I watched repetitively prior to them being born or being old enough to really want to watch movies with me. So this is one of the higher up there on the list for me. I really love the entire storyline, even though you like hate that you love certain parts of this movie, if that makes sense. So yeah, overall, I think it's a fantastic movie. It does kind of make me smile that it's like one of the few times that I remember my brothers not arguing and fighting over something that we all like paid attention and spent quiet time together.
All right. Steve, what are your thoughts on your first few screenings of this?
Yeah, so this was one I do remember watching a good amount when I was little. I had it on cassette. It was one I've always liked growing up because I've always, you know, I've always liked dogs. So one I've definitely gotten into. And I actually do remember watching the live action remake that came out in 96 of this film, too. Don't have as fond of memories of that as I do of this version. But yeah, it was definitely one that I've always enjoyed. And one that I really was one that was looking forward to. When I was doing my reviews of the films last year, this was one I was looking forward to and definitely very pleasantly surprised at how well it's held up over the years.
Yeah. What do you guys think of the animation style? Because there's definitely a difference here. Again, it's kind of you know, a little rougher in the background, I guess. Not everything is as fleshed out. What do you guys think of the change here? Miranda.
I don't know that I have an opinion on this. I know that sounds really weird, but like,
It's more about focusing on the foreground, I guess.
Right.
You know, with the characters and not as much detail, I guess, in the... everything's not exactly as finished, I guess you would say, in the background. I don't exactly know what that style is called. Steve, what do you think of it?
I'm not sure either.
Mm-hmm. All right, Steve, what do you think of it?
Definitely feels different from the last film we did, Sleeping Beauty, where they seem to have a lot of emphasis on background. But then again, in that film, you're in a forest, you're in castles, and all that stuff. Whereas, here being in kind of almost, I don't want to say a modern, it feels more of like a modern era film. In terms of the setting and the characters and the whole ambiance of it, definitely feels more like modern time as opposed to previous films like Sleeping Beauty and Cinderella that are set in such an earlier time period. But that's what I get from it.
Yeah, it seems to be take place as close to the release than any other movie probably up to this point. All right, so as for the movie, let's get into it. It starts off in London, England. Aspiring songwriter Roger Radcliffe lives in a squalid bachelor flat with his Dalmatian dog, Pongo. Pongo decides to watch women and their dogs walking down the street until he finds suitable matches for both of them. Spotting Anita and her doll, Dalmatian Perdita, or Purdy as we like to call her, Pongo drags Roger to the park to arrange a meeting. Roger and Anita fall in love and marry, as do Pongo and Purdy. So, Steve, what do you think of our introduction here with Pongo being our narrator, referring to Roger as his pet, and then the little meet cute that he sets up in the park?
Well, I think I like how they are telling the film from the perspective of the dog. So, it makes sense that Pongo would be the narrator of the film. And, that little scene where he's kind of watching all the ladies and their dogs walk past. And it's funny how, they always have that old expression where dogs look a lot like their owners and vice versa. And how every person that passed, they're almost like mirror, the owner and the dog are like mirror images of each other, which I thought was kind of funny. And then he finally lands on, Purdy, because she's a fellow Dalmatian, and he sees, he thinks Anita would be a good match for Roger, and then he puts this whole plan together of them to get to meet in the park, and he ends up inadvertently causing them to fall into the little pond, which was not sure how he planned, that was planned well for him, but it ends up, he gets, his plan ends up coming through. They start to connect with each other, and then he connects with Purdy, and then they end up, they they obviously didn't seem to spend a long time courting each other, because they seem to get married fairly quickly after meeting. So I thought that was kind of interesting, but I thought it was a nice little scene, a couple scenes to kind of introduce us to Pongo and to Roger and Purdy and Anita, and kind of set this tone for what's going to happen in the film.
Mm-hmm. Miranda, what do you think of the opening of this film?
Absolutely adored the opening. I agree a lot with what Steve said. Having him as the narrator, I think, sets a wonderful tone to this movie. I absolutely thought the part of bringing in the different owners and their dogs, because like he said, people make the comment of, the vice versa being like the other one. I thought it was really funny, and I like that it was present here and you could see that. And I love the meet cute. I don't know if that's the romance movie / reader in me that really loves that, but I really love the whole meet cute that happens. And I love that you knew that that's what it was called.
Oh, thank you.
So, yeah, I love that part as well. And I do agree that it seems like they do get married very quickly, but they also don't say what kind of time has passed. I know later in the movie they allude and let you know how much time has passed and the changing of the days, but they don't do that at this point. So I guess, to be honest, we don't really know how quickly they fell in love and got married, but I do love it's like a coupling of both. Mm-hmm. That, Roger finds his lover, and, Pongo finds his all together.
Yes. It looks like a very small ceremony. Like literally nobody's there. Yeah. So it couldn't have taken that long, but it wasn't like, you know, overnight. All right. So continuing on, the family acquires a housekeeper named Nanny and moves to Regent Park. Purdy becomes pregnant with a litter of puppies. Anita's spoiled, fur-obsessed former schoolmate, Cruella DeVille, stops by and annoys the family. In response, Roger writes a jazzy song to make fun of her. When the puppies are born, one appears to be stillborn, but Roger manages to save his life. Cruella then comes back and barges in again, demands to buy the puppies. Roger finally stands up to her, furious. Cruella vows revenge. So, Miranda, what do you think of Cruella DeVille? This is quite the entrance for our villain in the movie, and she is quite the character. What are your thoughts on her and where we've gotten up to in the story at this point?
I love that right off the bat, you can tell she's very, they go ahead and let you know she is wealthy and she is eccentric and she gets what she wants and she does what she wants. But what I love about it is she's not what you would call a wealthy socialite. I would call her a social parasite, really, because she just like leeches on and takes from, and she's known Anita from school. And I guess Anita maybe is the one person that, even though while Cruella is totally cruel and horrible, she still is nice to her. Because I think she even makes a comment. Roger's like, why do you put up with her? And she says something about, you know, well, she's my friend from school, or like she wouldn't have any friends if I didn't. I don't remember what she says, but it's basically it's that she feels for her. She somehow can still like, she still sees her in I guess in a different light. So I think it's very interesting how she's just, she pops in with so much like, I don't want to use the word sass because we get like, that's what we used in our previous episodes when we're talking about the fairies and other characters like that. This is more like sinister. She comes in with this sinister, like, I'll do what I want. You can't tell me what to do. Like, bossiness that I would call another word if this weren't talking about a child's movie. But she's another B word. And she doesn't care that that's how she's perceived, which I think is what makes her so great as the villain and as just kind of like the horrible person that you're supposed to hate, is that she doesn't care what you think about her and she's going to get what she wants.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There doesn't seem anything redeeming about Cruella. I kind of find it hard though, to believe that they're old school friends. I kind of wonder how that really worked out. Maybe they were like forced to be roommates and she had like had to be friends with her. I don't know.
I don't know.
Steve, what are your thoughts on Cruella and, where we get the, you know, the great song is written by Roger, as well as the birth of the puppies.
So I mentioned when we did the Sleeping Beauty review that even though Maleficent was a villain, there was still some, something about her that you could like her and almost sympathize with her. I really can't say that same thing here about Cruella. She just seems like she's such a mean girl. Nothing about her is likable. She clearly has only one love in her life, and that's fur. And I mean, she makes no bones about it. You know, the second she shows up, you know, she's only after one thing, and that's the puppies. Even though they haven't been born yet, at that moment, she makes it pretty clear and crystal that that's all she's after. And I love how Roger. Has that melody in already in his head, but he just doesn't have words for it. And then all of a sudden Cruella shows up, that's like when it dawns on him, he could just write about her. And, he's just this, and the song is really catchy. You really want to sing about it. And I think even though Anita knows that he's making fun of Cruella and she finds it kind of mean, you know, I think deep down she's kind of glad that he's doing this too, because, I think she wants to like Cruella, but at the same time she knows that Cruella doesn't like her and she's only after one thing. So I thought that was a nice little introduction to Cruella and to kind of her motivations and her outlook on life as a whole.
right. Yeah, Cruella is just, yeah, she's just a breath of hot air, basically. You know how people say they're from fresh air? She is like the opposite of it. Very inconsiderate smoker, too. You know, the ashes into the tea, puts it out in the cupcake. Yeah, very inconsiderate.
Like, she doesn't care. That adds to her, like, she doesn't care.
No, she just cares about herself and her fashion, I guess. So some months later, Nanny puts the puppies to bed after an evening of watching TV while Pongo and Purdy go for a walk with Roger and Anita. We then get introduced to Horace and Jasper, two burglars that were hired by Cruella. They pose as men from the electric company and steal the puppies. In response, the Radcliffes enlist Scotland Yard and put advertisements in all the papers. Roger suspects Cruella, but Scotland Yard can find nothing against her. So, Steve, so we have that fun scene where they're all watching, I believe it's Thunderbolt, the dog, the sort of the hero there. And then we get... you know, Horace and Jasper, a couple of cockney bumbling burglars. So what do you think of this sequence with them? You know, the puppies are you know, have personalities now and they all have names, as well as, you know, Horace and Jasper.
Just quickly to go back 1 second to when the puppies are born. One of the, I think, kind of the more unheralded scenes, I don't think it's talked about, is when they think they've lost the one puppy. And they give him to Roger, and Roger's kind of mourning about it, but then he kind of, you know, has an idea, and you see him just, like, gently rubbing the puppy and eventually bringing it back to life. I thought that was a nice little, I thought that was a cute little scene there. It kind of shows a different side of Roger that you don't see a lot with him throughout this film. I just wanted to kind of mention that really quick. I like how they're watching their little TV show, and we kind of get introduced to the puppies, and they're, like you said, they each have different personalities. And I actually love the little the Canine Crunchies commercial. I thought that was I thought that was cute. I love how they went and created these little, like, TV shows and the commercials, and really adds to the world, I think, of these Dalmatians. And there's another show that's on that we see later that we'll talk about that I want to mention. And Horace and Jasper are definitely very stereotypical pair of villains there. They got, you know, Jasper, who thinks he's the smart one of the duo, and Horace, the kind of the guy who kind of who thinks he's dumb, but he sometimes does some smart things that he doesn't even realize it. And the kind of little tense scene there where they overpower Nanny and steal the puppies. Really good little scene there. And then, you know, they think, and then the kind of, while they're kind of, you know, waiting to hear back from Scotland Yard, and Cruella ends up calling them to kind of offer her, you know, her sympathy I use the quotes there. And, you know, Roger is right off the bat. He knows what's going on with that. She's got to be involved somehow, but Anita kind of it's funny, like, Anita still kind of gives her the benefit of the doubt, even though, you know, Cruella pretty much just at one point tried to pay the money for those puppies. Right. And after Roger basically, like, put his foot down and said, no, we're not selling any of them. And Cruella basically vows revenge on them. And yet they still, Anita still kind of want to give her the benefit of the doubt, even though all the signs are pointing to Cruella being the mastermind behind it all. So I thought this whole little collection of scenes were good for to kind of move the movie along.
Mm-hmm. All right. Miranda, what are your thoughts on, the villains, the henchmen, so to speak, as the and the little TV scene we have here?
I love the TV scene. I can hear the Canine Crunchy song in my head, just like Steve said. Like, I love that little part. I do love that it introduces you to the little dog family and, like, all of their different personalities. And it kind of lets you see, because, again, we started this movie from Pongo's point of view. So I like that the dogs are having TV time, and the dogs are talking about dinner and bedtime. And it's not – Anita and Roger talking about, oh, we need to feed the dogs, or oh, we need to put them to bed, or something like that. It's all from their perspective. And I really, really enjoy that. Jasper and Horace, I felt, fit perfectly for the henchmen that she hires. I love that they both think that they're amazing, but they're actually these, like you said, there's these bumbling idiots that don't know what they're doing. You know what I'm like? They're just, they can't figure it out. And one has an obsession with food, which anytime you have a henchman that's obsessed with food, that's always going to like cause problems. I find that comically funny. Like I really do enjoy that kind of comedy in kids movies when there's a henchman that like, because he's eating a sandwich, he doesn't get something done, or he falls or trips or, you know, whatever. So I find the two of them to be like, on their own, really endearing. Like, I feel like it's the two guys from like Home Alone, kind of, you know, it's like,
yeah,
it's like
Harry and Marvin.
Yeah. It's like them, but maybe not as thought about, you know, not as smart maybe. But what I find really interesting about this whole thing is, you know, Anita still wants to believe. I think Anita is one of those people that just, she always sees the good in everyone. Because, I don't know, as a kid, I even remember going, yeah, Roger knows. Like, he's just determined that it is Cruella that did this, and he just knows that it's her. And Anita's like, we don't know that. But, I mean, come on. Cruella bought, what is it, 84 other puppies by legitimate means? So that's the other thing that I have. Like, she legitimately purchased 84 puppies for their fur. You really don't think she stole your 15? You know, like, it's very strange. But yes, so there's a lot going on with this whole like dog napping, but they are the best henchmen to have because you know things are going to go wrong so that they go right for the heroes later. And that's what I kind of love about them the most, is you know, after you meet these two, things are going to be okay. They might get rocky, but they're going to be okay.
Yeah, Nanny does hold her own, but she just gets, you know, the fact that she's outnumbered, she loses up against them.
I absolutely love Nanny, too. We haven't really talked about her yet. I adore Nanny.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right, so continue on. Pongo and Purdy use the Twilight Bark gossip chain to send news to all the dogs in England, starting with Danny the Great Dane. In Withersmarsh, Suffolk, old Towser the Bloodhound passes the word on to the Colonel, an old English sheepdog, and his cat friend Sergeant Tibbs. They investigate the nearby old DeVille place where puppies have been heard barking 2 days earlier. Tibbs sneaks inside and is nearly killed by Jasper, but sends word back to London via the Colonel that the puppies are found. Pongo and Purdy force their way back out a window and begin a long cross-country journey, crossing a flooded and icy river, running through the snow towards Suffolk. So yeah, here we go again, though, with the chimney. Horace and Jasper light a fire in this place, and the dogs see the smoke. I love the Twilight Bark. We get to see some of the dogs that we've seen earlier, as well as some cameos. We see basically all the dogs from Lady and the Tramp. We see Peg and Bull in the shop. We see Jock. We see Lady. We see Tramp. So it's a great homage, I guess, to the last set of movie dogs. And I love the Colonel. He's bumbling but smart. And Sergeant Tibbs is really the unheralded hero of this movie. Miranda, what do you think of this part where we get the Twilight Bark and, we have Sergeant Tibbs getting into action here?
We actually refer to the Twilight Bark in my household a lot. So Andy knows, I think Steve does. So I have two dogs now, had three until recently. And the small one we refer to as Karen. And I hope that doesn't make anybody mad because I think it's hysterical. And so when she turns into Karen and she starts her barking, we're like, listen, the puppy, no one stole the puppies. The Twilight Bark is not needed. It's noon. You're good. So like we refer to the Twilight Bark all the time, especially where we live now here in Slovakia, and we do so much walking with the dogs. Like if one dog barks, here's another one barking, and another one, and another one, and another one. It's just like a chain effect. And my husband's like, damn, Twilight Bark. Wonder what's wrong. So we refer to it a lot, and I think it's hysterical, and I love it. this whole sequence, this whole part of the movie, which I thought was is needed, is fantastic. I love that you kind of see dogs that we have met before in other movies. I love when Disney does that, and that'll happen again later where you see, as we continue through our series here, you'll see that again where they reference and you see small parts of other movies in the newest one. Tibbs going in and learning that they're going to make dog skin fur coats and like jumping to the quickness and saying, no, I've got to get back, I've got to tell them, is honestly one of my favorite parts of this movie. I love the Colonel and Tibbs and Cap, like that whole group there, and Captain. They're just like this fun group of a hot mess. Like, I don't know. They're kind of all a hot mess, but Sergeant Tibbs, who thinks like I am in charge and blah, blah, blah. And I love that there's Sergeant, Captain, and Colonel, but the Sergeant thinks he's in charge. So if you know rankings, you know Sergeant would not be in charge when you have a Captain and a Colonel. But I think that was very well done, and a smart little play on titles there by Disney as well, making Sergeant, who thinks like he's in charge and I'm the one, you know, but actually he would not be in that lineup with Captain and Colonel. But I love this. Oh, I can't say enough about it. I think it's fantastic. And again, you were right. You know, I cracked jokes at you the last pod that we did together when we did Sleeping Beauty, and you were like, the chimney. And I was like, let's start keeping a record of how many times the chimney causes a problem in Disney. And now I want to go back to the ones we've done before and been like, did the chimney play in any way? So now we are at count number 2. I think this is what, movie number 17 by Disney, and the chimney has caused problems at least twice in our 17 lineup. So
Yeah, we got to go back and check. We have to keep our running count.
I do. I want to go back now and see in those ones that we did before this. Did a chimney have anything to do? And I think, I don't want to say for sure, so I don't want to ruin it, but I think it did happen. So I'll let you know. I'll report back.
Yep, 2 yips in a buck. Steve, what do you think of the Twilight Park? And our kind of rad tag crew here.
Yeah, that's like a little sequence of scenes. The Twilight Bark, I thought, was a nice little thing there to kind of, because you wonder how dogs would send messages to each other, especially from at long distances like that. And you kind of figure they would just do nothing but bark the messages to each other back and forth. I agree. I like the kind of trio there of the Colonel, Sergeant Tibbs, and the Captain. I think they make a nice little ragtag group. Kind of interesting though that they refer to the place where the puppies are being held. You know, he does mention it as the old DeVille place, but Tibbs refers to it as Hell Hall, which I thought was a interesting little name. The fact that they would actually say that in an animated film is interesting, and I thought that was a kind of nice little reveal there, because they think when they go there that they're trying to find the 15 missing puppies, and then when they get there, they find out there's 99 total, and it's kind of like, holy crap, you know, you don't realize that they, you know, they went out of their way to capture 84 more puppies for Cruella's plan, and I find it, you know, interesting. Note there was that Tibbs went in to make sure and actually went and count to make sure that the 15 that he was looking for are there, which I thought was interesting. And at one point Jasper grabs him thinking he's a bottle and almost drinks him and, you know, causes a ruckus. But but I thought this was a nice little introduction to those three and also to the other puppies, and kind of, you know, interesting little note there, how Cruella needs that many puppies to get what she wants.
Yeah, I think I love this part of the movie. It is so much fun. And, you know, even, you know, you notice Cruella is like in bed, even her phone looks evil, you know, that with devil horns and everything. I was like, wow, they just really go to town here.
All right, isn't that her car too?
Yeah, well, yeah, her car, which I actually have a little diecast, a Matchbox version of. I think I have 2 of them, actually, now. But anyway, so meanwhile, Cruella tells Jasper and Horace that the police were on their trail. She orders them to kill and skin all the dogs by daybreak. That's kind of a... that's really...
Yeah, I've like, always wondered, why do you have to kill them? I mean, you can get their skin. It's like shearing a sheep. You can get their fur. Like, I mean...
Not Dalmatians, though. They're not sheepdogs.
Well, it's the way she would want it. It would be like a bearskin rug, so I guess you're right. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So, and then after she leaves, Sergeant Tibbs helps the puppies escape through a hole in the wall, but Horace and Jasper hear them and give chase. Colonel meets up with Pongo and Purdy, tells them of the trouble. The two Dalmatians attack Jasper and Horace, destroying part of the house and giving puppies time to flee. Pongo and Purdy reunite with their litter of 15 at Curla and Tibbs's home farm, only discover there are 84 more puppies with them. Upon learning from Tibbs that Curla intended to make Dalmatian fur coats, Pongo and Purdy decide to take all 99 pups home with them. So, who do we lead off with this time? Miranda? What do you, actually, no, I think it's Steve's turn. What do you think of, so what do you think of, you know, the escape starting to happen here? Poor little Rolly always gets them caught. It seems like, you know, yes, he's a little hungry, you know, got to feed a growing child, but, you know, he seems to be the one lagging behind. What do you think of the escape and when Pongo and Purdy find out there's 84 more puppies there?
Well, this is the other this is where the other TV show comes on that I actually really like. It's when Jasper and Horace are watching What's My Crime, which I cannot believe there's never been a like in real life somebody hasn't done a show like that. Like. I don't know. It just seems like, and especially in the air, you know, in the 2000s, when it seemed like they were making reality shows for everything, that you didn't have a show where you brought a criminal on and tried to have a panel guess like what his crime is, and he gets a two weeks paid vacation as a reward, as you know, once he's paid his debt to society. And it made me think to myself, it's like, what if they bring someone? What if they brought someone onto the show that had a life sentence?
Ooh.
Like he doesn't get to enjoy. He wouldn't get to enjoy his reward.
Right.
So I thought that was a funny little. I always thought that was kind of a funny little funny part there. But yeah, this is where we find out, you know, Cruella's plan that she wants them, you know, made into coats, and you know, this is where we kind of see her paranoia start to kind of show, because she's like, she wants them to do the job now, and they're kind of like, you know, they're kind of lackadaisical about it, and. You know, to the point that she actually slaps him in the faces, and it's basically like, you know, you will do this tonight. To the point that she threatens to call the police and kind of turn everything on them. That's how, you know, desperate she is for everything. And the little chase sequence where you know, you mentioned about Rolly getting stuck up. Let's not forget Lucky would like to spend all his time just watching the TV with them.
Yes.
So.
Yes.
It's only, you know, when they kind of toss him aside that, you know, they're able to get him to go with them. But yeah, I like the little running through the house, and Tibbs trying to stay one step ahead, and then Pongo and Purdy show up, and they fight off Jasper and Horace, and you know, again, you mentioned, you know, Chimney's, you know, being a kind of a hair, kind of a, you know, adherence to the villains. But you know, Horace at one point lands in the fire and ends up crashing into Jasper, and they cause a big destruction of the house, which is you know, was an interesting little scene. And then we find, you know, they end up following them to the farm where Pongo and Purdy find out about the other 84 puppies, and then again, they're just kind of like, yeah, we'll just take you guys with them. You know, our owners won't mind having 84 more puppies in the house. We already have 15. So, and then I like the little battle there with where the colonel kind of lures Jasper and Horace behind the captain, and then Tibbs, you know, using the captain basically as a launcher, where he sends Jasper and Horace into the wall. I thought that was kind of funny. He's like, he kind of like uses the captain's ear as like a, almost like a trigger. And that's when he, you know, uses his leg to kick Jasper and Horace away. So I thought that was a, you know, fun little sequence there, kind of, showing the puppies kind of the puppies reuniting with Pongo and Perdita, and, Jasper and Horace kind of getting theirs in the end. for the time being.
Yeah. Miranda, what did you think of this part of the movie?
I really love this part. I love that the puppies, even though there's now 99, that the 15 original ones don't kind of get swallowed in, and they still have their own little personalities, and they're part of this, like, this getaway, this breakaway, basically. And it is funny that Rolly and Lucky always seem to somehow be like, but Mama, I'm hungry, or like so into the show that he's not realizing that, like, hey, we got to get out of here. Like, oh, we're going to die. I think that's just like that toddler mentality of like, it's not the end of the world. I need my show. Like, don't bother me. Like, you know, I just find it very endearing that they make these puppies basically toddlers. And they're like, but Mama, I'm hungry. And like, it makes sense. It's very truthful to what would actually happen.
Yeah. All right. So then the Dalmatians start their trek. They're being pursued by the Badens, as they're called. All water has now turned ice, so they use the creeks to avoid leaving tracks. They shelter from the blizzard in a dairy farm with a friendly collie and some cows as they make their way to Dinsford, where a black Labrador is waiting for them in a blacksmith shop. Cruella and Jasper and Horace catch up, so Pongo has his whole family roll in a sooty fireplace to disguise himself as Labradors. The Labrador helps them board a moving van, bound for London, but melting snow falls on Lucky and exposes his spots. Cruella pursues and tries to ram the moving van. The Badens in their own van attempt the same thing and accidentally smash into Cruella's car, which sends both their vehicles into a snowy ditch. The moving van returns to London as Cruella throws a tantrum. Jasper, having had enough of her, tells her to shut up. So this is an incredible sequence here. I love the leading of the puppies down and how they try to outsmart Cruella, basically. The collie, you know, and the cows give some much-needed rest to them. Mm-hmm. And then the whole plan. And Cruella is just bat-poop crazy here with the way she's driving, you know, that car of hers.
She's totally reckless.
She's trying to ram this poor guy in the moving van off the road. He has no clue what the hell is going on. Yeah, she's off the deep end. I mean, she was nuts before, but this is really nuts. Miranda, what do you think of, them ending up at the collie scene with the cows and then with the whole black lab and then the harrowing snowy road driving?
Oh, I love this whole scene. I think if I remember, I think what I really liked about when they're kind of taken in by like the cows, I think the cows give their milk.
Mm-hmm. Yes, they do.
Obviously, Purdy would not have, that poor doggy would not have enough to take care of 99 pups. Like, she just wouldn't. I loved that they showed that all of the animals are working together to help them save these dogs. Because they can't let them go hungry either. So the cows are helping feed the puppies, and they're trying to give them, you know, a moment of solace and just a moment to figure everything out. And I thought the whole hiding them in soot was genius. I loved that part. And I think this is at the point of the movie where one of my favorite lines comes out. I can't remember which puppy it is. And if you guys know, you can tell me. I can't remember which puppy, but he's like, my nose is froze. My toes are froze. Like, he's talking about, just because, like you said, it's everything's frozen over. There's snow everywhere. But one of the little puppies is like, everything is froze. And I use that all the time. I said that to my husband yesterday when we were walking the dogs. I was like, he's like, are we ready to go back? Do you think they've had enough time out? And I'm like, yes, because my nose is froze. My toes is froze. So I adore that little puppy and his little, like, real-life problems. Like, I think it's fantastic. Cruella, I interrupted you there. She is reckless. Like, she has no care and intent of anyone's life at this point, because it's even, like, a really windy, curvy, kind of rocky, hilly road, if I remember. Mm-hmm. And so, like you said, this guy has no idea why this crazy lady who is, like, screaming and yelling and, like, driving with, and her eyes even get, like, all crazy and big and change colors, I think, at this point. Like, she has beyond, she's gone past tantrum. She's having like a mental breakdown and being just like horrible, which, I mean, she ends up crashing, but at the same time, like, this is crazy. Like, this is beyond crazy just for this Dalmatian skinned coat, which is disgusting, but whatever. But she is beyond crazy at this point. That's why I feel that she ranks pretty high in villains, because she doesn't have any superpowers and she's not really that schemey. She's just ridiculously bonkers.
Yeah.
Like, totally off the wall.
Yeah. Yeah. I think if I'm going to guess which puppy said, I'm going to guess it was Patch. May have had that.
I can't remember.
Yeah. And it's kind of funny too, is I don't know if you guys watched The Walking Dead, but something similar happens early on where they figure out to put, the zombie innards on themselves, and they're walking, and of course it starts raining, and because the walkers can detect you by scent, I guess, that you're, you're not rotted. So I kind of laughed at that, because I was like, oh, I could see where I've seen that used again in later media. So Steve, what do you think of the stage of the rescue escape, so to speak, and Cruella just off the deep end?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it is Patch that's the one that starts, talking about saying like, oh, his nose is froze, his tail is froze. I think it's kind of upsetting, because like they've been traveling all that way, and then the collie comes up and basically says, oh, come, we got a shelter for you. But it's like back a ways where they came, and then they have to turn around and go into the wind now, which I'm sure couldn't have been very pleasant, But yeah, that was a nice little homey scene where the cows are, kind of letting them, drink their milk, and the collie gives Pongo and Purdy whatever scraps he had, and they get some much needed rest, and then they meet up with the Labrador in Dinsford, who tells about the truck to London, and then Cruella and the horse and Jasper just kind of scope in the town to kind of find them. And yeah, that was a pretty ingenious little plan there by Pongo to have them roll in the soot and basically act, kind of be mock little Labradors. Unfortunately, the only thing they didn't plan on was the fact that that it would be kind of a tepid weather day there in Dinsford, and that the snow would melt and it would drip on them and wipe the soot away, to the point that Cruella, eventually, I think one of them got, I think snow kind of fell completely on them and took away their whole costume. Mm-hmm. And that's how, Cruella figured it out. And that whole chase scene is definitely very intense. And like you said, yeah, Cruella by that point, at one point she crashes in a ditch, and her car, who can't, I'm sure her car is not very, built to handle snow. And eventually, she gets to the point where it gets destroyed a bit in a tree, and the top comes flying off, and she's still driving it. And yeah, that one spot there where she rams the back of the truck, and like you said, she has the devil eyes basically, because she's gone by this point, she's completely off the deep end. And and then you see Jasper and Horace coming down the hill trying to ram get in position to ram the truck, but Horace freaks out and ends up pulls the steering wheel out and causes the van to lose control. And then he ends up running to Cruella's car. And that van wasn't very sturdy, because that van fell apart very easily after colliding with Cruella's car. And then they, I thought that was kind of interesting. And then they ended up in the ditch, and she, finally breaks down mentally, and Jasper's just like, ah, shut up, I'm tired of hearing your nonsense. but yeah, it was good to kind of see Cruella get her comeuppance there, because we never really hear or see what happens to her or to Horace and Jasper. Like do the cops find them, or do they end up just kind of getting away? But it was kind of nice little touch there to kind of see them, in the rubble of their car, in their vehicles, knowing that their plan is eventually falling apart, and she just finally breaks down and can't take, it's just like, just she's done with it. And I thought that was a nice little kind of touch there. And again, that like you said, that truck driver, he has no idea what's going on, why she's doing this to him. And he's, you know, kind of blurts out, like, ah, crazy woman driver.
Yes.
So, but yeah, this was a nice little kind of climax to this film.
Mm-hmm. So they get back to London, and a sad Nanny and the Radcliffes are trying to enjoy Christmas, and the wealth they have acquired from the Song About Cruella, which has since become a big radio hit. The soot-covered Dalmatians suddenly flood into the house. Upon removing the soot and counting the massive family of dogs, Roger decides to use the money from his song to buy a big house in the country, forming a Dalmatian plantation. And that's how we end our story. So, Steve, we get a happy ending. Our bad guy has, you know, who knows what happens to Cruella, you know, post this. Her, Jasper, and Horace end up in jail. Maybe they end up on What's My Crime? Who knows? But what do you think of our kind of a cherry on top, our ending here?
I thought it was good. Kind of interesting hearing the song actually play on the radio. Interesting that they didn't have Roger sing, because Roger's got a nice, you know, pretty nice singing voice, but I guess, you know, he's just paid to be a songwriter. And yeah, that scene where all the puppies come marching in through the into the house, and then Pongo and Perdita find Roger and Nina, and they're all kind of confused at first because they think they still think they're Labradors. And then, but then they kind of, I think one of them is complete, I think it's Lucky, is completely uncovered. So that's when they kind of realize who they are, and then they start wiping them away. And they go to this little, this weird kind of method into counting up how many puppies and dogs there are in the house. And then they eventually realize there's 101. And, you know, sure enough, when he's like, what do we do? You know, what do we do with all of them? And Roger's like, yeah, we'll just keep them. And kind of making good on Pongo and Purdy's prediction there that their owners will just, you know, take them all in. And that's when, you know, Roger comes up with the idea of buying a place in the country. And then he sings Dalmatian Plantation to kind of close things out, which I thought was a nice little touch there. But yeah, it's a good little scene. And like I said, nice little happy ending that everyone gets reunited and the family gets bigger.
Mm-hmm. All right. Miranda, what do you think of the ending of this film?
I absolutely love the ending. I feel like this is my dream life. Maybe not Dalmatians necessarily, because I don't have Dalmatians, but a giant plantation full of dogs just like doing whatever is like life goals. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a fantastic ending to a movie. What I will point out that I find very interesting, and I do kind of like, is typically we always catch the villain. Now, what happens to them, we really don't know, but we always catch them or kill them or something. And in this instance, we have no clue. I am assuming they're back in China, Lalo at DeVille Manor, but we don't catch them. So I kind of like that. I think it's different because, again, mm-hmm. It was focusing more on the dog's point of view. So they really wouldn't know what happened to Cruella at that point. Like, they wouldn't, like, their dogs, unless the TV was on and they saw the news story of what happened to Horace, Jasper, and Cruella, they wouldn't know. So I think it kind of lends well into having the dogs tell the story, because at this point they're like, oh, she's gone. We're back with our mom and dad. I now have a lot of children to take care of, and Roger just bought us a lot of land, so I'm good. So I think that's fantastic that they kind of don't tell you, for a lot of reasons that maybe I'm overthinking, but that's where my brain goes, is that they wouldn't know. They wouldn't know. All they would feel is that they're safe and they're fine now.
Mm-hmm. All right. Yeah. I mean, God bless them for having 101 dogs. I mean, I had pointers growing up. I had my Abercrombie, and we had another female dog named Honey, and they ended up having 5 puppies. So that was a lot to have in one house. I mean, the puppies, you know, eventually we found homes for them. Most of them related to the family or close friends. But yeah, I couldn't imagine. I love dogs, but oof. So talking about this film a little more, let's go, you know, we'll talk about it. It's not really present in the parks very much. You may see Cruella at some villains things, but other than that, you may see an icon here and there. I believe they have a giant Pongo at the Pop Century Resort, as I think, or the movies. I think All Star Movies has a Dalmatians wing. But other than that, there's not a lot they're doing with them in parks, which is kind of unfortunate. But you do see them a little bit. But this was when I was doing the research on this, I found out that they had tried something different because of how expensive Sleeping Beauty had become, and Walt was kind of getting disenchanted with animation. That Ub Iwerks, who was basically one of Walt's right hands, had been experimenting with Xerox photography to aid animation, and he had modified a camera to transfer drawings by animators directly to animation cells, which eliminated the inking process, saving time and money, while preserving the spontaneity of penciled elements. However, because of its limitations, the camera was unable to deviate from a black, scratchy outline. Disney would first use this in Sleeping Beauty, and then a little bit in the backgrounds, but for 101 Dalmatians, one of the benefits was that it was a great help in animating the spotted dogs. Chuck Jones had said that Disney was able to complete the film for about half of what it would have cost if they had to animate all the dogs in spots, which you kind of notice a little bit. So what do you guys think, though, of the legacy of this film? I mean, obviously, there were spinoffs. You know, we talk about it with some of the other films we've talked about where they did the sequels, the direct-to-video. During the whole direct-to-video, they had 101 Dalmatians 2, Patch's London Adventure, and then they had the live-action remake. So Miranda, what do you think of some of the offshoots that we've gotten or maybe retellings of 101 Dalmatians?
I don't remember watching the 101 Dalmatians 2, which is Patch's Adventure. I may have, but I don't remember it at all. The live action I really enjoyed. That's from like 96 with Glenn Close. I really enjoyed that one a lot. I thought it was really good. Thought she portrayed Cruella very well. There was a TV series apparently when I was doing my research before we started recording. There was apparently a television series, 101 Dalmatians. I don't remember this at all, so maybe someone out there has, but apparently there was also a television series, and then it's been in the works for several years, but we are getting a villain movie backstory about Cruella, like we did with Maleficent from the previous movie that we all reviewed and watched together, or we didn't watch it. Well, we kind of do. We turn it on the background, but yeah, so I think if you're asking me, like, would I move forward? Like, would I recommend move forward? I'd say the 96 live action is a really good one. Mm-hmm. And then I would assume, like, everything else that maybe we'll get a remake of live action. But I think this one shouldn't be done because they did it in the 90s. And while that's the thing is we're doing live action remakes of all of these, like there was one of Lady and the Tramp and Mulan and several others. I think this one should not be done again because 96 is, there was nothing wrong with it and it's already been done. I am excited to see where the Cruella movie goes, though. So maybe that will be finally completed at some point, and we could talk about that.
Yeah, I really love the one. I think Glenn Close just chews up the scenery and has so much fun portraying Cruella. Mm-hmm. I'm very interested, though. I kind of like that, though. I agree with you. They should not do another full live action, but I like where they're going with Cruella starring Emma Stone and showing mm-hmm. that perspective. You know, it's kind of like it goes after like the Cobra Kai model. Okay, we're gonna go back to this world, but we're gonna do it from a different character's perspective. We're gonna follow this one.
Right.
You know, I saw the first Maleficent. I really don't remember much about it. I have not seen the second one. I really don't have much desire to.
But it was good, Steve, but the first was better.
Yeah, which was better. Steve, what do you think of some of the offshoot properties that they've done of this franchise?
Yeah, I agree about I think I do. I do remember watching, like I said, the live action remake in '96 with Glenn Close. I think that may have been actually the first one they ever did. You know, we talk about the more modern era remakes and how that's kind of become the norm in the last decade. But I mean, they started doing it, you know, as early as now. I mean, as early as '96. It's kind of interesting. I know there was a sequel, 102 Dalmatians in 2000. I did not see that.
Oh, yes.
I saw it. I think I saw it, but that one. Yeah. I think I saw it because my kids were little, but I don't remember much about it. I think it was they added another Cruella-esque character. It was, I believe it was Gérard Depardieu was a similar character because what happens is Cruella gets reformed. She goes to like therapy or something and gets reformed, and this guy designer kind of brings her back to her evil ways. Anything else you guys want to talk about, like where does Cruella, I know we you guys gushed about Maleficent in the last episode, and I do love Maleficent as well, but where do you see Cruella, where is she ranking, Steve, for you in terms of villains?
She's definitely up there in terms of, you know, a memorable villain. It's kind of interesting because I feel like she doesn't get recognized as well as like some of the other villains do, like, you know, like Maleficent and the Evil Queen from Snow White and, you know, villains that we'll talk about down the line, specifically from like the early 90s, they're kind of, you know, held in that high regard as all-time greats. And I feel like people put Cruella in like that right next tier under them. Like they kind of put her in the same vein as like a Captain Hook and maybe like the Queen of Hearts, in terms of they're really good villains, but they're not, they don't have like that. They don't have enough to be kind of put on that next pedestal. I think she's definitely one of the most memorable villains in the Disney canon, just before how insane she is, and like her you know, she has like just like one motivation in her life, and that's to get Dalmatian fur coat, and she'll go to whatever length she has to go to get it. And I think she definitely should be remembered as one of the all-time best villains in the Disney film history.
Ah, okay. Miranda, what do you think of Cruella?
I agree that she is up there on the list. I think she is also overlooked a lot, and I think it has to do with the fact that she doesn't entirely accomplish anything, really, does she? I mean, other than stealing the puppies, she doesn't really accomplish anything other than showing us how crazy she is. And I think that she doesn't, because she doesn't do it with magic, she doesn't try to kill anyone, or she doesn't actually, like, accomplish doing anything. I think she's forgotten, but I think what makes her so amazing as a villain, and while she should be so high up there, is because I've mentioned before, when we were talking, just like how unhinged she could be and how just she truly needs some sort of therapy. She's crazy and she's out there. And so I'm really excited to see what they do with Emma Stone playing as Cruella, because I want to know what they think made her this way. She's just crazy. Like, I know I've said that like 10 times, but I don't know what else to say. And I think that makes her highly up there, because I think that makes her more relatable as a villain, and I think it also makes her more realistic as a villain. That she, I mean, there really could be a Cruella in this world, I think, is what makes her up there in the list of villains and who should be at the top and who's just not so great. Is she could be a real person and a true problem the way she is on screen.
Yeah. Yeah, she's up there. I put her slightly above Maleficent, in my opinion, just because she's just, there's nothing redeeming about her. She is just bad, evil, nasty, crazy.
She's just a normal evil person instead of like an evil mistress or an evil whatever. She's or a bad queen or somebody that got in with the voodoo. Like, she's just an evil person. She's just a horrible person.
She's just bad, rotten to the core.
Right.
All right. So that's going to pretty much wrap up our discussion of this fine film. We will be back shortly with our next film. We're going to be moving forward into the 60s with The Sword in the Stone, one of Miranda's personal favorites, correct?
Yes. Yes, yes, yes.
All right, but let's go around and see what else everybody has going on out there in terms of podcasts, social media presence. Steve, what do you have to point people towards?
Well, I was back over here on the PTB and Pop feed. I was on a most recent episode of Making Mount Rushmore, where me and a couple of guys got together and we tried to determine what we thought were the greatest one-hit wonders of the 80s and the 90s, what songs belong on the Mount Rushmore for those two. So some pretty good discussions there, if you want to go back and listen to that. You can also find me, of course, at placetobenation.com. I have my usual accoutrement of articles, the eventual previewing, the box office report, and the wonderful list of Disney that's going on, where I'm ranking the heroes and princesses, villains, songs, and all the films. So I got all that going on. You can typically find me over on Facebook. I'm around the Place to Be Facebook page. Lots of great discussions, questions, tournaments, all sorts of stuff going on over there. So that's pretty much what I got going on.
All right. Miranda, what do you have to point people to?
Most of mine is about the same. You can find me here, of course, on Place to Be Nation at the group we have on Facebook, where we have some really interesting conversations. You can find me on Telly and T here at the Disney podcast. I frequently appear on others when I can, because time differences are no joke, people. And of course, always over on the Ginny Position, you can find me at Geek and Sassy. If you follow me on any of my social medias, if I end up guesting somewhere or doing something new, some sort of new work, you can definitely hear about it there. Find me on Instagram at Mom's a Nerd, as well as Twitter, which I don't do very much of, but I'm there.
All right. So for me, here on the Pop feed, I have lots of great shows. Among them, as Steve mentioned, Making Mount Rushmore, Year in Pop, Blockbuster Rewind, Laugh in Theater, Pop Goes to the Movies. Hopefully we'll have some movies to talk about soon. Pop Goes to the Couch, where anything that's popular in streaming, we are doing reviews on it. It will be weekly if the shows are dropped weekly, but if it's a big Netflix dump, we will then break it up into a few parts to make it easier for everybody to listen to. Also on the Wrestling feed, check out Great Debate Wrestling as well as Evolution. And don't forget, check out all the great feeds here as part of the Place to Be Nation family and our affiliates. That is the Place to Be Nation Wrestling Network, the Ginny Position, and the North-South Connection podcast feed. Check out placetobenation.com each and every day, and go to Facebook, join the Place to Be discussion group. Lots of fun, as Steve mentioned as well. So, for Miranda Berthold and Steve Riddle, I am Andy Atherton. Thank you for joining us on Pop Goes the Classics, and we'll see you on the next episode. Take care, everybody. Two yips and a bock.